Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight because I'm still in Lappeenranta near the Russian border in Finland. I'm at a conference, Limits, looking at what happens if sustainability fails and how does computing deal with that, which is part of the ICT4S conference. And I'm with
Alan Borning.
Alan Borning, who's a professor emeritus of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington. The emeritus means he's retired, but he doesn't seem to be slowing down.
I slowed down a little bit, but yes, my wife has noted this. Are you really going to retire? And by the way, are you getting paid for this?
You're going on a boat trip tomorrow, though.
I am. That's true.
Where did you grow up?
Moscow, Idaho. Named after the one in Russia.
You're not going there tomorrow. You're going to St. Petersburg tomorrow.
I'm actually going to Vyborg.
Oh, are you?
St. Petersburg would be fun, but more than a day.
Okay. So, what's Moscow, Idaho like?
It's a small town in Idaho. I guess when I was growing up, it was population 15,000. Now it's 20,000. The University of Idaho is there, though, so it's an academic town and then otherwise farming. So it's a pretty rural and conservative state, but Moscow, Idaho is a little bastion of progressive thought, given the university.
Did you know what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Probably an academic. My father was a professor at the university there in political science. Although his family and my grandfather and so forth were all farmers and sort of, game wardens and electricians and all. It's always been a bit of a puzzle how he ended up an academic because none of the others did.
So through that family, you were always connected to the land?
Certainly a historic connection.
And you wanted to be an academic. Did you know what in? Or did it
probably something scientific. I spent a lot of time, messing with different electrical things and building things, and then chemistry experiments, and collecting insects. And my parents were really quite tolerant. In those days, you could buy fairly dangerous chemicals, and nobody told you no. So, I remember flooding the basement with chlorine gas at one point, and we had to move out of the house a bit and let it air out. Things like that.
My son Henry has decided that his next project is a rocket.
Mm.
And
I made some of those.
There's some dangerous chemicals involved.
Yes, there are.
Good. So
I'm still here. So
yeah, there's proof of one. So what did you do about that? Did you take yourself off to university?
Well, I did. Well, so I went to Reed College in Portland, which is really a small liberal arts college. Kind of socially liberal and very conservative academically, and so I was a math major there. But they didn't have computer science at all. There were no courses in it. But there was a computer in the basement of the administration building, and they let us have free rein with it. So I did everybody did a senior thesis, and I did it on prime number factorization and such. But I was also interested in different economic structures. So I spent a summer living on a commune out in the woods and was doing reading and, what are different ways of organizing things? It was the 60s, so we're doing 60s stuff.
Was the key book, was it still punch cards?
It was.
So you have to be careful when you ask people if it was still punch cards. Some people say, no, it wasn't that old. And other people say, yeah, we were using them until much later than that.
It was punch cards the whole time, yes.
Must have been a very different time for computing.
It was an IBM 1130. I think it had 8K of memory. So that's 8,000 bytes of memory. So pretty small.
And did you go straight on to grad school?
I spent a year working and then went to grad school at Stanford in California. When I got there, I was working at the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab doing computer vision and so forth, and was thinking a lot about the social implications of what we were doing. So I was wondering about automation and unemployment and the fact that this research was funded by DARPA or ARPA at that point, the Advanced Research Projects Agency from the Department of Defense. And so sort of midway through the first year, I decided I'm really not sure if I want to do this. Maybe I want to go into forestry or something else. So I dropped out for a while and lived out in the woods again in southern Oregon, doing salvage logging and tree thinning and stuff like that, another commune. I like living out in the woods, but eventually I kind of missed the intellectual side of things too. We talked about doing projects and stuff, but you wouldn't be grappling with philosophy or ideas. So I decided I'd go back to graduate school, but try to find something that meshed with my political and social interests. So I ended up doing something with computers and education and worked at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center with Alan Kay, who was my dissertational advisor, along with Terry Winograd. So I was interested, I did a dissertation about graphical constraint systems for building simulations for education. But we were very much inspired by, how can you make computers that are something kids would like to use? I actually even tutored some junior high school kids with an Alto, one of the very early personal computers. We also ran a Computers in Society seminar and kept on delving into those topics.
That was a Xerox PARC. It was a very big name.
Yes.
Exciting things happening there at the time.
It was. And we even recognized that it was exciting then, because there was nothing like it going on elsewhere. It was the graphical user interface and laser printers and Ethernet and mice and icons and windows and so forth.
And precursors to what became the tablet or the iPad and that sort of stuff thought about.
Yes.
With the connection to your work, as an education tool, is where those sorts of things, that thinking came from?
We were inspired a lot by Seymour Papert and the Logo Project, so it wasn't all invented from scratch there. Similarly, object-oriented, I worked in the Smalltalk group, which was one of the places where there was a lot of early work on object-oriented programming, but we were very much inspired by Simula from Norway. Kristin Egard and Ole Johan Dahl.
You said you wanted something that was more aligned with your political and social sort of feelings.
Yeah, so there was this feeling of, we can make computers that can be a tool people want to use for communicating with each other or delving more deeply into their education. There was a really an interesting book by John Markoff called What the Dormouse Said, which is the influence of the counterculture on the development of the personal computer. I liked it because I knew a lot of the people in it. Grew out of that in some ways, that there was this vision of computers as personal tools that you could use. Of course, it wandered badly off course, but that was the vision.
And you said you were teaching Computers in Society?
We had a seminar. I did teach for a while, but introductory computer science. And after that, I spent a year in Edinburgh in Scotland in the Artificial Intelligence Lab there, and then got a job at the University of Washington in 1980 where I stayed ever since, except for sabbaticals and trips. So in University of Washington, I had a career in the first half of it in programming languages and user interfaces and constraint systems. Kept on thinking about computers and society issues. So in the early 80s, I was one of the founders of Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. So in that period, Reagan was the U.S. president. He announced this so-called Star Wars system, the Strategic Defense Initiative. So the goal, according to Reagan, was to be able to have a Teflon shield over the U.S. So you would have anti-missile systems of various kinds, and if the Soviet Union launched a missile attack, they could just be destroyed, and it would render them, in Reagan's words, impotent and obsolete. It was not a vision that seemed to have any possible hope of being realized. And so this was one of the motivations. So a set of us worked on that. My own work was more on computer system reliability in nuclear war. It's kind of another depressing topic, but there, you know, it's important. So the kinds of things I was looking at were launch on warning, protracted nuclear war, limited nuclear war, and so forth. So here's sort of the convention. Here's a little bit of nuclear war fighting doctrine. I don't know if you wanted to get into this, but we'll go ahead. So sort of the conventional treatment of nuclear weapons is that they are very different than conventional ones, even, you know, large bombs and tanks and the whole thing. And there's this thing called MAD, mutually assured destruction, which is MAD. But the idea is if the Soviet Union attacked the U.S., the U.S. would attack back, and everybody would be blown up. So it was just so horrible that nobody would do it. So that was the idea. But then there would be concerns about, well, what if there was a way that the one side could knock out the weapons of the other? Then, you know, they couldn't retaliate. So that was one of the big concerns about this, the Reagan Star Wars initiative. So there was a discussion of, well, here's one strategy, which is called launch on warning, so that rather than getting reports on the telephone, you know, a bomb exploded here, we'll say, well, we've just seen them on the radar, so an attack is underway and we will retaliate. So the problem is it's a, you know, half an hour flight time for a ICBM from Russia or the Soviet Union to the U.S. or vice versa. So that's not a lot of time to react. And then if this is combined with a crisis and bad communication, you know, it really could be bad. So I looked at some false alerts of various kinds. There was an example in 1979 where there was a chip that failed and caused messages to be sent on the communication system saying, you know, we detected an attack. It turned out they were this is a terrible design. They had filler messages on this network saying, we've detected zero missiles. One chip failed, started, oh, we've detected, you know, two missiles or five or something like that. Fortunately, there was nothing much going on politically at that point which would lead somebody to believe that there really was an attack underway. So it got called off. And another false alert was, somebody loaded a training tape on a tape drive, things like that. So I wrote about that, and then also theories of, we could have a limited war, if we had good enough communication systems, and all of this seemed quite insane. So I ended up spending a lot of time reading about it and studying software engineering questions, gave talks about it to church groups and community groups, International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War, and so forth, and had a CACM article about it. So that was...
So how close were we to that computer games movie?
I don't think very close, but out of luck. So a very early example of a false alert that is instructive was in 1956. So there was a great deal of tension. That was the Suez Crisis in Egypt. And there was a series of events. There was a report of a set of bombers, which turned out to be geese on the radar. There was a report of troop movements, which turned out to be just a drill, and several other things that all sort of looked like, gee, maybe there really is an attack. And there was it was an example of how in the fog of war, or at least high tension, things can get confused, and it takes a while to sort them out. So I think that was maybe closer, and of course then the Cuban Missile Crisis was closer. But I think the stuff in 1979, 80, and so forth was not near causing a nuclear war. So anyway, just to fast forward for a little bit, I worked on this for a while. I was on the board of directors for 4 years and so forth, and eventually people moved on, I moved on. I gave a talk a few months ago to some undergraduates about that and did some research again, and unfortunately we're sort of reviving some of these old ideas. So Trump declared the Strategic Defense Initiative that said, reconcentrate on stopping all weapons. I don't think anybody took him, well, no. I don't know whether people took him too seriously, but that's worrisome. And then there is a lot of talk about modernizing nuclear weapon systems. So one thing would be developing, small tactical nuclear weapons. So from a military point of view, you can see why one of these would be useful. It could, blow open a bunker or something like that. That would be too difficult to do conventionally. The issue is that it is blurring the line between conventional and nuclear war. Before, there's this, don't go nuclear because then everybody's dead. But then saying, well, we'll just have this little small tactical nuclear weapon. That unfortunately, or something in an artillery shell or something like that, blurs it. So things are looking worrisome again. Plus, of course, then there's the proliferation problem of, there was the treaty with Iran, which I think was really a great success in terms of halting their weapons program and getting them to agree to that, and then Trump has said he's pulling out of it. So, and then there's North Korea and so forth. So things are looking a bit dodgier again.
When that Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility was established and operating, was it a sort of a lone voice? I know there's a few people involved, but was...
I think there was a fair number of people, and I think when you talk to computer professionals, there is a lot of sympathy for it. I mean, the message is pretty simple. If you have an extremely complicated system that you can never test and that you expect to work under conditions that have never happened before, how can you think it's going to work 100% reliably? I mean, that's ridiculous. But having somebody with software engineering background saying that is useful. I don't have a software engineering background. I did a lot of research. A more important voice there was David Parnas, who is a software engineer and furthermore had done a lot of work with the military. So I had really been skeptical about military funding and so forth. So you could dismiss me, but Parnas was in the middle of all that. He was on a panel for the Strategic Defense Initiative and became really disgusted with the whole thing because nobody seemed to think it would actually work, but it was just a source of a lot of money that they could use for other research projects. He thought this was dishonest. So he became radicalized, really, and then started giving talks about that. He wrote a series of essays that were widely cited.
Do you think at the time that the fact that people were standing up and talking about that social responsibility had any impact on wider computing, but perhaps even wider, of a sort of a suggestion that there, as professionals there is a deeper responsibility? Or was it something a few weirdos were doing in their, and stick to their day jobs? But
I think it's somewhere in between. So there was, it was definitely more than just a few weirdos. I think there was widespread concern, certainly about the nuclear weapons and the Strategic Defense Initiative. Something that was a harder sell was saying the military should not be the main source of computer science funding, at least in the U.S., because that's biting the hand that feeds you.
So how did you pivot? Because at the time, your day job was you're still focused on object-oriented programming.
Right.
And you've pivoted to, I'm going to say, your current work. It still is your current work, focus on values and on the SEED project, which we'll get to. How did you...
It was more than a moment, but I... when was this? This was would have been the late 90s. There's these sets of things that I care about, like environmental questions and sustainability, and then urban form. I don't like automobiles much. I think we're really overuse the things. And so I said, how I can do this in my civic life, but it's not very well connected with to work on object-oriented programming or constraint systems. So I decided I would really refocus my research and consciously just started looking around for projects to work on. I ended up meeting a fellow, Paul Waddell, who was in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington, who was building urban simulation systems, SimCity Professional Edition. So the idea is, you can simulate what happens in an urban area over periods of 20 or 30 years under different circumstances. Like, suppose you say, well, let's put a lot of money into public transportation, or let's put a lot of money into automobiles, and then what will the results be in 30 years? So that seemed like an opportunity to do technical work and then have it impact the political process to help say, well, here are the consequences of continuing to build more freeways, for example. And there's this phenomenon, just a little bit about how simulation gets used. People have been simulating transportation systems for since the 50s. And the very early days, they just assumed that the patterns of land use where people lived were fixed. And you just use simulation to decide how big should the freeway be. And what this ignores is that there's an interaction between land use and transportation. If you build a freeway network, as was done in the U.S. and Los Angeles and Dallas and lots of cities, then people can live further away in suburbs, and then they drive more, which means you need more roads, and then you get this kind of feedback loop. So one of the things we were particularly interested in in this project was land use transportation interactions and the environmental impacts. So if you change the transportation system, how does that change where businesses and people locate, and how does that change their transportation use? So I worked on that for 10 or 15 years, got some National Science Foundation money, had some students. I was also working with Batya Friedman back then on value-sensitive design, and we did some work on how human values came into that kind of simulation work. So here's an example. The way people understand the results of these simulations is with indicators. So for example, what's the population density, or what are the number of tons of CO2 emissions from transportation, or what percentage of open space is there? How much energy do you use for transportation, and so forth. And it turns out that the indicators that you pick and the way you describe them is political and value-laden. So some people might be particularly interested in environmental indicators. Other people might care about equity things. Are you spending the money fairly, or are you spending it more in one area and less in another? Other people might care about economic growth and low taxes and things like that. So we explored the value space and came up with this kind of nice set of distinctions in value-sensitive design that I've still used. So we talked about explicitly supported values and stakeholder values and separated them. So in the urban sim work, the explicitly supported values, the things we were trying to support in the system itself were things like accountability, transparency, supporting the democratic process. hopefully not too controversial. And then stakeholder values might be things like environmental sustainability or equity or economic growth. And some people might care about some of those, but not everybody. And then we want to, and part of being responsive to the embedded in the democratic process was providing support for people to answer questions about those different values. So that was one project, and that went on for quite a while. Eventually, Paul moved to Berkeley and took the project with him, and so I moved on. It's still going on. I saw him a couple weeks ago, actually. It was nice to catch up. And another project came along about public transportation and real-time information. So there was a PhD student in our department, Brian Ferris, who had been working in robotics and was not completely satisfied with what he was doing. He was a firm believer in public transportation, and on the side, he had been building this real-time information system called One Bus Away. And he was going to leave school. But I talked to him and said, wait, we can turn this into your PhD dissertation, which we did. And so there's Brian and then another student, Kerry Watkins, who's in civil engineering, did PhD dissertations on real-time information systems for public transportation and how that impacts people's choices and ridership and satisfaction. By now, it's pretty widespread stuff, but when we were starting, it was not so easily available. Kerry had a background. She'd been consultant in the public transportation for 10 years or so, so she understood how to talk to the government agencies, which was essential, since otherwise they would maybe not be so interested in doing this. So that was another sort of environmental project.
When you talked about that distinction between the explicitly supported values and the stakeholder values, and it was interesting the things you put in the stakeholder values, so it's things that not all people believe in, so it might be sustainability, but also economic growth.
Yeah.
If we don't state those values, is the economic growth one just implicit in what we do? We build new stuff, we make new devices, we believe in some sort of future of technical utopia.
Well, I think it's implicitly supported, the economic growth one. Then there's a rhetoric around supporting sustainability values, but there's a disconnect. So there's sort of one. I think there's certainly people that think climate change is just a hoax and there's nothing to it. But certainly the majority of scientists and educated people, I would say no, this is a problem. It's just that, well, if we just keep on doing what we're doing, but we recycle our plastic water bottles and be careful with how much we drive and so forth, maybe we should be limiting flying, but I don't know, and that one's a little too hard. It'll be all right. I don't think it will, but I wouldn't go so far as to say, the only value is economic growth. The other ones are important too, but the collision is not being seen.
And you put transparency in the explicitly supported ones.
Right.
Is there or perhaps should there be, a requirement that our values are made transparent in the work that we're doing?
I don't know if I'd say it's a requirement, but it certainly, in some cases, essential. And I think it, is always a good thing to think about doing.
So one of the things you're working on now is the SEED project. What does that stand for?
That stands for Solutions for Environment, Economy, and Democracy. So this is a couple of years old. If the listeners want to go to our website, it's seed.uw.edu. We've got a manifesto and some other documents. So here it's done in collaboration with my friend and colleague Lance Bennett, who's in communication and political science at University of Washington. So he's a social scientist, political scientist. And then Volker Wolf at the University of Siegen has been active in it. And a set of other folks in Sweden, Germany, places in the U.S., Bonnie Nardi at UC Irvine has been working on it as well. So here's the idea. there's different ways of explaining it, but let me start with the environment part. So the climate change and the climate crisis, I think, is the major environmental question of our time. And suppose we really want to do something about it. My view is we need a different economic system. That a economic system that relies on unending growth is just not compatible with really doing something about climate change. I mean, we can make things more efficient. We can try to reduce things here and there. But if we are really going to reduce enough, it requires a different economic orientation. But saying we need that is politically impossible for the most part. Economic growth is assumed to be a good and the answer to a large number of problems. So that invokes, and there's certainly other kinds of crises of democracy at the moment. I mean, things are fraying badly in the U.S. and with what is truth even, and what are facts. They're fraying in Europe with populism and the rise of the right wing and questions about refugees. There's Brexit and so forth. So things are in a bit of a mess. What we're trying to do in SEED is say, well, these problems are all interrelated and we need to take an integrated approach to them. Just saying, well, we'll only work on the environmental questions, but economics is outside of our purview. Means that we can't really do what needs to get done. So the way we're approaching SEED is, we've had some workshops and discussions and so forth, but we're working at a couple of levels. One is pretty basic political communication questions. Lance is writing a book, for example. So this is asking questions like, well, how do we want to live? What's the economy for? What kind of economy do we want? What kind of democracy do we want? And I think you can ask these basic questions and then poke some holes in some of the underlying assumptions about unending growth. Then another part of, so Lance again is a political communication guy, so that's his forte. Another part of what we're doing is saying, well, suppose that we accept that we need this fundamental kind of change, how does this play out in different sectors? So one of the things I've been working on now, we just had a paper at this workshop on it, was about the information technology sector. So the dominant economic model for Google, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, increasingly Microsoft, Amazon, and so forth, is what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. So,
it's a great term, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's very, very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
So for a pure surveillance capitalism firm like Google and Facebook, their services to the end users are provided, quote, free, but at a cost, the cost being very intensive information gathering about personal information, cross-correlation with other sources, and then increasingly behavior manipulation. And so this really undermines privacy, kind of obviously, but also the democratic process and even human dignity. So, well, what are some alternatives to this? So again, to situate this in SEED, it's saying, well, suppose we have this vision of an alternate economy and one that lives within the and respects the limits of the earth and the environment. Well, how does this play out in the IT sector? It doesn't play out as surveillance capitalism.
And what sort of alternatives are there?
Well, so I don't know entirely.
Because we kind of recognize that, yeah, it's a problem that Facebook's got all our data and Google's got all of our data, but we get quite a lot of good from them.
Well,
and
absolutely.
Can we carry on doing it?
Well, yeah, I think we don't want to throw out the good part. I mean, I still want to be able to search the internet and, you know, do internet searches and stuff and use email. I think some of the social media stuff maybe we could cut back on. I'm the wrong age group to be looking at this, but at least for myself, Facebook just feels kind of creepy, where I'm supposed to be on some public display and say I'm doing these interesting things and posting this cool picture, and you know I don't feel like I have that interesting a life. I don't feel like doing this all the time. I just don't use it really much. But you know, for teens, their lives are lived on this, and I think it's a huge psychological stress. So that's why I'm saying we don't necessarily just want to replicate it, but with a different funding model.
You talked about integrated problems. Can we compute our way out of those problems?
No. But I want to start from, you know, what are possible solutions, and I think they will involve, you know, changing the way the economy is done, changing what we think of prosperity means, having a democracy that actually functions and listens to what the people want, as opposed to the economy and people with lots of money. So computing certainly plays a role in this, but asking the question, can we compute our way out of it, puts the computing part first, and I don't think it should be first. Questions should be, you know, what do we want to do, and then how can computing help, and also how can we avoid having it make a mess of things?
Because it helps us do things more efficiently and faster and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it seems that it's mostly the wrong things. Although
there's some right things.
There is a benefit of the efficiency of systems.
Yeah. Well, so here's one example is the public transit information system. So it's nice to know, did my bus come already, or is it just running 5 minutes late? It really takes a lot of the stress out of using public transit to have that kind of accurate information. So I think that's a good thing.
But if we're trying to do something like fix democracy, because yours needs fixing.
It does, doesn't it?
In particular. Is there a set of computing solutions that can help us do that? I mean, to some extent, computers have got us into this mess.
Yeah. Well, I guess they're certainly going to play a role in getting us out of it. For example, dealing with disinformation campaigns and the like. Here's another project I had. I a PhD student a couple of years ago. We were exploring discourse and debate online and how to make it more civil and involving better listening. So, as folks know, the internet has a huge amount of political information and then discussion and debate, and the quality is mostly ghastly to awful, where people are, you're an idiot. No, you're a bigger idiot. And not really listening to people with different points of view and, in fact, sort of reinforcing more and more extreme positions. So we had this system called the Living Voters Guide, which was ran for about 5 years. It was a citizen-generated guide to ballot measures in Washington State, citizen initiatives and referenda. And what we tried to do is set up the interface so that it would support more deliberation and listening and less yelling and calling the other person wrong. So it had a particular kind of interface form. It was a pro-con list. So the way it would work is you would have a particular initiative, like was a couple of years ago was privatizing liquor stores in the state of Washington. So up until a couple of years ago, they were owned by the state. This was a prohibition era move to control liquor. Some of the big retailer, Costco, basically funded paid signature gatherers to put this on the ballot because they thought they would make money selling booze. So the initiative then would be up there, and then you would have this pro and con list, and you could see some pro points and some con points that other people had written, and you would drag them into your list. Like a pro point might be, well, there's no real reason that the state should be in the business of selling liquor. That seems like something better left to private enterprise. And a con might be, this is likely to increase teenage drinking. And another con point might be, it'll be harder to control things. And a pro point might be, well, you could raise more money by taxes or something like that. And then if you had another idea of a pro or con point, then you would write your own. but then contribute it back to the pool. So then it was a social media system, and these ideas were being shared. So what it was nudging toward is, first of all, deliberation. If you have a list of 10 pro points and 0 con points, that just looks unbalanced. You know, do you really believe there's absolutely no disadvantages to this? And you know, that seems a little off. Another is that rather than the sort of the name-calling part, that, you know, when in a lot of deliberation systems, just sort of the latest post shows up there, which encourages you to put something provocative. Here, you are nudged toward putting a pithy, factual, or a value claim that then can be, okay, I think I believe this, and bring it over. So another thing that it let you do is say, well, for people that support this measure, what are the positions that they like? Or for people that are against it, what are the positions they like? You can go sort of explore it. You could also look for points that appealed to people both who were pro and against, so that, you know, they thought it was reasonable. Something
we're not particularly good at is that knowing what the people who think something different actually think. Mm. And one of the things that social media has done is separated those two areas. We're surrounded by a bubble, and you have to actively, you know, go and follow something from someone else that, and then you find there's this whole other world of people that believe something entirely different to what you believe.
This is really mixing the people, though. So you would see the pros and the cons from people on all sides of the issue.
And that's a sort of empathy, or hopefully some sort of empathy basis to it.
Let me mention one other experiment we did on this, which is, you know, people would make a lot of factual claims. You know, this is going to cost $10 million in revenue, or it will increase teenage drinking or something like that. And, you know, with lots of factual claims on the internet, how do you know it's true? So we partnered with the Seattle Public Library, the reference librarians, for a fact-checking service. So anybody could flag something and say, please fact-check this. And then the librarians would do research on it and then say this is consistent with some reputable sources or not. We had another paper on that. So what it was doing was trying to leverage existing trusted institutions, libraries in this case, and then mix them with the, sort of this new social media age.
You talked about nuclear war, which had a very clear threat, and depending on what the politics are doing, you know, it could be starting next Friday. Hmm. For the issues that we're facing now, they're much more slow burn.
Yes.
And I was just writing down the trying to explore in my head what you were talking about, the mutually assured destruction. But we've got that if we don't do anything.
Yes, but slowly. Yes. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to be motivated. Well, this is going to happen, you know, years from now. I mean, there's a whole series of barriers. One is we're, as humans, not very good about thinking about what's going to happen in 30 years, and we better start doing something about it. And the other is, well, I don't, you know, that doesn't seem that different outside than it did last year, and there's actually a bunch of snow last winter, and so forth. So it is hard to grapple with. Plus, then there's the disinformation campaigns around it.
Some questions to end with. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
First of all, living within the limits of nature and the earth and respecting it, having an economy and society that are built within and respecting those limits so that the economy isn't taking over or doing things, and then a society that enables human flourishing and prosperity, maybe with a different version of what prosperity means. You know, I think we have basic needs as humans for, you know, medical care and adequate nutrition and so forth, but not necessarily you know, jetting off for a week vacation somewhere or having enormous numbers of gadgets.
Maybe New Zealand's well-being budget might have an impact.
Yeah.
At least people will notice it, I think.
Yeah.
That's what we hope anyway. Unfortunately, at home, most of the media commentary was, where's the money?
Hmm.
But internationally, because I don't particularly care how much gets spent on this, that, or the other thing, that bigger headline is the headline. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think the one bus away, the transit information system. So it's got several hundred thousand users. I was unfortunately up way too late last night on a board call because we are forming a legal nonprofit to run this thing. It's actually connected in my mind with Seed, since the alternative for getting transit information, at least in the U.S., is mostly surveillance capitalism. So Google Maps and Bing all provide this, but they're tracking you also. And then there's startups with lots of money from venture capitalists, but presumably they're not doing it as a charity. They're expecting to gather lots of users and then gather data too. And so we're providing an alternative. So it's playing out what's an alternative to surveillance capitalism in a particular domain. Well, that's why I think it's important.
Is there a model for capitalism without surveillance?
Well, I think in our paper we talked about partial solutions, which was indeed capitalism without the surveillance part. And there are companies doing that, like DuckDuckGo is a search engine that sells advertising but doesn't track you in between searches. There's other examples. I think those are only partial solutions. I think other things, like the nonprofit model or for public transit information, government funding directly, co-ops, worker-owned things. I don't know what all, but I think conventional capitalism, at least in the sense of unrestrained growth and maximizing shareholder value, ignoring the other things, is not compatible with sustainability.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because I actually do some sort of a very immediate political stuff about transportation in the state of them and the environmental caucus at my political party's 43rd district, the 33rd district Democrat. So I do that kind of stuff. But then this more academic Seed work has an activist side to it as well. But we're trying to support activists. I mean, I'm not so much a marching on the streets kind of guy. It's more ideas and policies and frameworks. But I think that's important.
But I think you've had a long career, including involved in the development of the values as a thing which is considered in computing.
Right.
Could have a much bigger impact than marching down a street.
I think
if we can get
correct.
Everybody to take into account values as part of the designs of the computing, which, as we know, is ubiquitous everywhere.
Yeah, I agree.
There's a lot to be said for that.
Mm.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I like doing something about these huge problems that we have. I like hanging out with people who are interesting to talk to and challenging, and we can exchange ideas about them. I guess hope. So it's easy to get kind of pessimistic about all this, and I actually don't really try to evaluate what are the odds that we will make all this work. I'm not going to place myself on the optimism-pessimism scale unless somebody makes me. But I think there are things that have a possibility of working out, and there's some hope of making them work out and pick something good and then work on it, and then the results aren't really up to me, though.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Further playing out these discussions about surveillance capitalism and alternatives.
And if you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would you have happen?
I would change the political system in the U.S. and worldwide to take the money out of politics, to have a democracy that actually represents interests of people.
What's the smallest thing that we could do to make the biggest impact on that?
vote. So, you know, my friend Lance Bennett studies this sort of thing, and he looks at sort of political activity on the left and the right. And by almost all measures, you know, there's a huge amount of activity on the left in terms of people marching in the streets, getting involved in activist organizations and so forth, but not voting. And so that doesn't work very well in democracies.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Look for things that you can do personally that motivate you. See how it ties in with the bigger picture, but you know, don't get overwhelmed with that. Think of, you know, how is there some part that I can work on? So, you know, an example for me was, you know, I have this seed project, which is a very large scale set of ideas about environment, economy, and democracy. And then, well, here's how it plays out in one particular sector, public transit information. That's a small thing. But then I can say, well, this is actually a way of doing things that doesn't involve surveillance capitalism. And so it's, you know, an example of how to have an alternate economic model.
Thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Each week we talk with somebody who's making a positive difference, and we try to see the world through their perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Alan Borning, who is Professor Emeritus of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. You can find our podcasts on sustainablelens.org. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Ann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of premier local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.